some of the key features of the Arctic regions, not only in terms of their past history and their particular geographical and physical structure, but also as they appear today in the evolution of our world and with all their possibilities and also their constraints. This talk will be illustrated by a substantial amount of slides, so I hope that you will not object being in the dark for a while. And of course, if you so wish, I'm quite prepared at the end of this presentation to answer some question, of course, in my field of competence. So let's start first to see how Arctic regions have been discovered. Lost at the rim of the Earth, and sometimes shining white and blue under the permanent sun, sometimes frightening and elusive into the deadly whiteout of threatening mists, the Arctic regions have been considered for millenniums as forbidden areas of mystery and desolation. For classical antiquity, they lay on the boreal side of the ocean, beyond any known structure. Since, as it was written, ita est rerum natura post omnia oceanus post oceanum nil, that it is in the nature of the things that beyond everything is the ocean, and that beyond the ocean there is nothing. There, in the midst of this Mare Cronium, the Dead Sea, Hippocrates placed the Hypae Hyperboreans. These Hypae Hyperboreans were supposed to live a marvelous life, a life where, among flowering gardens, they were living at the sounds of songs and music while the winter stars sank to rest in the deep ocean. They were even so happy that when Apollo visited them in his swan-drawn carriage, he wept tears of joy which dropped solid as golden amber, the same golden amber which already was sold from the Baltic Sea and reached Misenum 1 millennia later. But there also, the most reliable scholars described mighty, impressive wastes infested with drifting ice, where land and sea fused into this ill-defined misty horizon of the sea lung discovered by Pytheas, the Massalian navigator, the only single man who, some 4.5 centuries before Christ, dared to challenge the quiet kingdom of God in the northern waters. That was considered indeed as a challenge, and it was said quite often that there was no reason to go there. And in that sinister world, where Plutarch told that the time Cronos himself was kept in jail, where the waters were locked and where the light was fringed by a permanent night, it was felt that we should not go in an area to disturb that kingdom of gods. However, a certain number of maps of cosmographic theories give us a rather fair appreciation of how the evolution of the ideas came through the antique period up to the year 1000, roughly. And I will try and attempt now to show you, through a group of maps, a certain number of this antique interpretation. This, as you do know, I think if we could have the light out, that would be fine. This view of the northern regions has been taken from the Apollo spacecraft, and you can see very well here Greenland, and would be here northern America, covered by this vortex, and on the other side, the still frozen Arctic Polar Ocean. I think it might be better maybe to take this light off, if you can too. And we'll come back a little later.
I think it has to be done down there in the front.
Sorry? Will it be here?
No.
Ah, thanks a lot. Very good. Thanks a lot. So here is the world as seen by Hesiod and Homer some 900 years before Christ. As you will see, the world was centered on the Ocumen, the Mediterranean, and it was like a disk swimming into a circular ocean beyond everything was unknown. For Eratosthenes, the ocean was all around a circular world, and on top of this is this northern land discovered by Pytheas and told by him to be the most septentrional of all known lands to lay. When the Roman Empire started to invade the northern part of Germany, they discovered the population living over there. And finally, the septentrional part of Europe got into knowledge. You can see here, on north of the Ripian Mountains, the Hyperboreans, and Thule, which appears here in the Northern Ocean. For Tacitus, also explaining in his work Germania the structure of the septentrional people, you see that Thule is in this Mare Pigrum, that the Dead Sea, and which is on the north of the European part, with also all this population, the Goths, the Cimbris, the Chauci, which will later on play a major role in European history. The famous Arab geographer Edrisi gave a beautiful map, which exists only in two copies now, one in Cambridge and one in Paris, of what he called the 10th northernmost climate. And its 10th northernmost climate, you can see here Norway, Denmark, here would be Great Britain and Scotland, and on top Iceland, which appeared in what he called the tenebrous sea, Mare Tenebroso. A first invasion of northern territories was done in the years at the end of the 8th and 9th century by these mighty, powerful people from the north, the Vikings, when they moved south and southwest in their drakars. You know the Vikings, they came from Norway, from Sweden, and from Denmark. And with the help of this longship, as the one that you see here, the Oseberg ship in Oslo, they reached America, as you will see, in the year 1000. You see here the different tracks of the Viking routes, first all over Europe and around the northern tip of Scandinavia into the Black Sea, then on the west, when they discovered successively the Shetland Islands, the Orkneys, the Faroes, Iceland, and then with Erik the Red, Greenland, and further down with Leif the Lucky, the new world of Vinland and Markland. Here you see some remains of the Viking constructions in southern Greenland. Here it is the Brattahlid Fjord where Erik the Red landed, and you see here the remains of the church which was built there at around the year 1010. By the way, it will be this year in August that will be celebrated the 1000th anniversary of the discovery of Greenland by Erik the Red, precisely in that place, in Brattahlid, in southern Greenland. It was such a powerful colony at that time that there was a bishopric, and that bishop, nominated directly by Rome, had a cathedral, and you see here the remains of the cathedral of St. Nicholas in Igalico, which at that name was called Gardar, in the South Greenland. And the bishop's grave is there, and they have found Bishop Jon, who was living there at the turn of the 12th century. The most spectacular building which remains from the Viking period in the northern countries is the Valse Church in Greenland, South Greenland, which stands still standing up and which is dating from the beginning of the 14th century. Then, as you do know, the whole colony disappeared somewhere in between the 15th and the 16th century, and that Greenland was lost again for a couple hundred years before Frobisher and some other discoverers discovered again not only the land but the remains also of the Viking settlements. Of course, this was transcribed into maps, and the famous map of Adam of Bremen on the Scandinavian kingdoms show not only Thule, which appeared already in the preceding maps, but Grönland, as you can see here, Vinland, and after this, that ocean which is partially frozen that had been discovered. Another important move towards septentrional countries was initiated by merchants when they were trying to find a shorter route to go to Cathay and China. You know that the commerce with China was very important, especially for spices, for silk, and all kinds of delicate products, and it had to go the very long and cumbersome way around Africa and through the dangerous Indian Ocean. Mercator, the very famous Dutch cartographer, Flemish cartographer, developed at that time a North Pole map where he showed at the summer, at the upper tip of the Atlantic Ocean, a circular maritime passage all around the Northern Pole area, giving the impression that China could be reached through a transpolar route, or at least a circumpolar route, in free water up to the Strait of Oman, of course, the Bering Strait. It is on that map that the Amsterdam city sent an expedition in 1596 under the heading of a very famous pilot, Willem Barents. Unfortunately, the ship of Barents was frozen in close to Nova Zemlya on the northeast coast and was obliged to winter over. The ship was destroyed eventually during the winter, and the sailors and the expedition leader spent the whole winter in a hut that they built on the spot. This contemporary drawing, which is dating from 1598, shows the wintering hut of Barents and of his companions in the year 1596-97. It might be of interest for you to know that this hut has been found at the end of the last century by a sealer from Hammerfest, northern Norway. That means almost three centuries after the Barents trip, and that they found in the hut all the different objects that you can see here, exactly in the same position and exactly alike they are on the drawing. In particular, that clock that you can see here, which can be seen at the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam. After this trip of Barents, of course, the map was amended. It was amended because Barents, on its way to Nova Zemlya, not only reconnoitred the whole coast of the Nova Zemlya, but he also discovered a new land. That new land, with spiky mountains and big gletschers going to the sea, he called Spitsbergen because of these spiky mountains. And here it's marked Nieuwland on this revised Mercator map of 1606. You see here a part of Spitsbergen in the very famous Magdalena Bay, where a few years later, in 1606, Henry Hudson made also a long navigation and discovered in the bay that there was a great amount of whales and he said, as many as carps in a pond. This was enough to attract to Spitsbergen a great deal of whalers, and for the next two centuries, the northern waters in between Bear Island and the upper tip of Svalbard have been navigated every summer by the whaling fleet. Here is on a map by Hondius, middle of the 17th century, you see the whaling ship, and the whales are driven on the shore, and see, you see the kukres, where the blubber is boiled and the train all prepared to be loaded on the ship and later back brought back to Europe. You see here also a fishing seed offshore the Barentsberg, that means the volcano of Jan Mayen Island, in the middle of Northern Atlantic. And you see here what remains of the whalers. Here are the whaler stumps, which can be found all around Spitsbergen, this one in Magdalena Bay. Generally, the coffin was covered by a heap of stones to protect the grave from the polar bears. Now, this upper part of the world has been created relatively recently, and I would like to speak about it for a little while. Indeed, as you can see, at the origin, that means at around 300 million years ago, the whole North Atlantic we are fused together in a large mass which was positioned much more south. Then, starting from the Cretacean period, the active Cordillera started to push apart the continents. The first was when Africa was severed from South America. Then, when Eurasian bloc was severed from Northern America. Then, finally, at around 1.5 million years ago, the active Cordillera in the northern tip of Northern Atlantic severed Greenland from Scandinavia. Could I have the light, please? Thus, as you can see, the Arctic region, and especially the central polar sea, the Arctic Ocean, is of a relatively recent creation. But the building blocks are very old shields, some of them dating back 1 billion years, which have been positioned progressively towards the north by the active movements of the Cordilleras. Those Cordilleras, by the way, well, we'll see later on, which are still active today. After a period of stability of nearly 20 million years, temperature dropped at the onset of the Pliocene, and the winter cooling of the large land masses positioned north increased the meridionality of the mean surface winds. Cold land surfaces became then very quickly covered with ice. At around 3 million years ago, an extended glaciation covered the northern hemisphere. That glaciation lasted until the end of the Cenozoic period. You know that a very elegant theory developed some years ago by Ewing and Dunn gave an explanation on the way the Arctic Ocean evolved during this lengthy period, and especially during the last 1 million years. This, in fact, started with the Brunus Normal Epoch, with the onset of the glacial Pleistocene. According to the model of Ewing and Dunn, there has been a flip-flop mechanism with regular alternance of warm and cold periods associated with an open or closed Arctic Ocean. The measurement of the paleo temperatures during this period by Emiliani and Shackleton involving isotopic determinations of O18 levels in oceanic cores show remarkable period fluctuations of the world climate during about 600,000 years with a wavelength of nearly 100,000 years. The following explanation is given by Ewing and Don. In a first step, the Arctic Ocean, ice-free, is a site of a permanent cyclone, which drives moist Atlantic air northwards and results into heavy rainfalls, building large coastal and inland ice caps on circumpolar continents. As time goes on, these ice caps grow and generate numerous icebergs through the coastal glaciers. At the same time, and as a consequence of the freezing out of atmospheric moisture into ice cap, the mean level of the ocean drops by maybe 150 to 200 meters. That seals the Bering Strait and some also of the important North Atlantic Passage, including the one between Great Britain and Iceland and Norway and Spitsbergen, throttling almost completely the North Atlantic drift. With no more advection of warm Atlantic waters, further cooling of the Arctic Ocean occurs, and it freezes out. On this new extended cold polar mass, an anticyclone develops, driving cold, dry easterly winds, whilst the general circulation is shifted to mid-latitudes. The obvious consequence in the next step is that the precipitation rate decreases and the permanent ice dries out. The release of this water provokes a major marine transgression, which opens again the maritime passages and brings back the Gulf Stream into the Arctic Ocean. The result is a rewarming of the climate, progressive melting of the pack ice, which disappears, and we are back to an open Arctic Sea under cyclonic influence, as in stage one. This is a very elegant theory. It's not completely proven yet, but which gives a fairly good explanation on the way the climate evolved at this period. At any rate, the activities of the main cordilleras is, as you know, demonstrated only at geological times, and we can say that by the end of the Neopleistocene period, the geographical structure that we know today was established. That means, as you can see here, a semi-enclosed sea having only very narrow communication with the other oceans, either through very narrow straits, like the Bering one, or the straits of the Arctic Canada, or through rather shallow passages, like the one which is in between the North Atlantic Norwegian Sea and the Barents Sea here. The only deep communication passage is in between the central Arctic Ocean and northern Atlantic here through the Fram Strait in between Greenland and Spitsbergen. And inside the Arctic Ocean, you have some major cordilleras, including one, which is still fairly active today, and two extincts, the Alpha Ridge and the Ran Ridges, which are dating back from the period of maybe 60 to 50 million years ago. Despite this apparent stability, the northern habitat was unsubstantially different from the present period for purely climatic reasons. Indeed, in the last 200,000 years, and since the Middle East period, northern lands have been submitted to major successive glaciations separated by warmer interstadials. The Middle Ridge 1 and Ridge 2 to Ridge 3 periods each lasted at around 30,000 years. But the real glacial age came some 90,000 years ago with the onset of the Würm-Wisconsin period, and it lasted for nearly 50,000 years, with an acute period of bitter cold between 20,000 years and 10,000 years BP. As we can easily see, this is a fairly recent event, and the Arctic regions are just starting to recover from this severe stress and restore their soils and ecosystems seriously damaged by the heavy, aggressive ice caps which extended as far south as mid-latitudes. This explains indeed why the Arctic region, despite the fact that they are constituted in great part by very old shield, dating, as I told you before, more than 1 billion years, pushed northwards some million years ago, have nevertheless extremely young biological ecosystems. We did not have time to mature yet on equally young soils. Now, these northern lands have been inhabited by ancient men for tens of thousands of years. And there are archaeological evidences that in the Neopleistocene period, some 40,000 years to 35,000 years ago, Neanderthalians moved northeastward in the cold Arctic tundra following their big game, mammoths, bears, and boss bison. Indeed, as ice receded during interstadials, wandering tribes took over the subarctic and Arctic lands of northern Europe and Siberia. Near 25,000 years BP, at the peak of the Würm IV glaciation, the climate got so cold that most of the runoff of northern lands was frozen into ice caps. The mean level of the seas went down by nearly 200 meters, and the Arctic Ocean turned into an inland frozen sea. The Bering Strait becomes then a dry land bridge where cold Arctic tundra conditions did prevail, and as such, it offered a safe pathway for Siberian Arcto-Mongoloid hunters following the occasional migrations of their game. Thus, ancient men walking east took foot in North America and there diversified. It is felt by many of the paleontologists that this migration was not an international one, but an occasional one, just following the game, moving in that direction that tribes, the one after the other, moved in the direction of the east and arrived in the northern tip of America, where they were locked by the extents of the ice cap in the south part. From the common epigravation nucleus, the Athabascan and Algonquin Indians developed inland, whilst the Paleo-Eskimo, hunting sea mammals or following the muskox way, established themselves all along the northern rim of the Arctic lands. Considering this early penetration of man into Arctic regions, we understand that the Arctic regions differ completely from their southern counterpart. Antarctica has always been a barren land and has never supported any human development whatsoever, until the very recent times where the white explorers made pioneering expedition and established themselves into scattered temporary bases along the coastline. Conversely, boreal countries have been the motherland of native circumpeople for more than 30,000 years, and the Inupiat, Yupit, Aleut, Konyak, Athabascan, Klinging, and others are all born there, and their great-great-grandfathers also. And it can be very easily understood that they hold some good reason to claim aboriginal rights. But as we have seen, they did not remain the sole inhabitants of the Great North. And in the Middle Ages, on the wake of the maritime expansion, they were pushed apart in certain areas by the Vikings, as I have just shown to you before. And then the route was open for the daring fleet, which from the 15th in the 19th centuries sailed north to fish cod, collect precious furs, sea mammals, ivory, and hides, to hunt whales, and try and discover on the northwest and northeast shorter maritime passages towards the reaches of Cathay and China. I propose that now we look through some slides in order to see that human history of Arctic regions in some examples, and then we will revert to the physical properties. This is just the end of the physical slide showing the active Cordillera into the Arctic Ocean and the extinct. And this is shown by the seismic activity that you can see here on the active part and which has completely disappeared on the extinct fossil ridges. This is the situation as it was 40,000 years ago. As you can see here, the Bering Strait was open and the bivacial tradition projectile points populations which were on the north of Siberia had no possibility to go to Northern America. The situation changed when, at the Würm IV period, that extended glaciation froze down the Arctic Sea and decreased the mean level of the ocean, and you see here those populations extended eastward into the Northern American region. Here is a summary of this early penetration of the North. As I have put here on that slide, you see the Arcto-Mongoloid movements coming into the northern tip of North America. Here, diversification into Eskimo, remaining generally on the coastal range, and the Indians going far inland, and which will later on move down to South America within the next 10,000 years. Now, most of the Eskimos remained along the seashore, hunting sea mammals, some following what Egil Knut and the paleontologists working in northern Greenland have called the Muskox Way, reached the Ellesmere Island, crossed the Robertson Channel, and moved here into Perry Land to settle near Independence Fjord, where they have been studied by Egil Knut, and where they have left circular stone circles which are dating back for Independence I about 4,000 years and for Independence II a bit over 2,000 years. Then the Eskimo moved on the west coast, and you have, you know very well, the successive civilization of Dorset and Thule before moving also through the southern tip to the east coast. The result of this is that the circumpolar regions are now the home of a certain number of well-established ethnic groups. The Eskimos, here in green, the Indian, the Lapps, the Eskimos you find also around the northern tip of Greenland and southern area, the Lapps, the Ziyayans, Voguls, the Ostiak, the Samoyeds, very close to the Lapps with their reindeer culture, the Tungus, also with the reindeer culture, the Yakuts with the Arctic horse, the Yukagiri, the Chukchi, the Kamchadal, and as you can see, the whole circumpolar area is inhabited and has been so for thousands and thousands of years. Here is a Lapp from northern Finnmark. A typical Eskimo house on the eastern side of Greenland. You can see here the stone house on the Sermilik Fjord in the Angmasalik district in summer. The Eskimo of the Angmasalik district are amongst the best kayakers in the world. It's very well known for that. They are hunting seals. They have also kept some of their tradition, like the drum dance. And here is in Teddy Singertak dancing in a little village, which is Tenitekilak, the old Tiderida, on the Sermilik Fjord area, eastern Greenland. They have a northern settlement on eastern Greenland, which is quite big, The score is Bisun Village, which can be reached sometimes every year, most generally every other year by ship. You can see here the summer pack is still very thick and difficult to navigate. These are an Eskimo couple from southern Greenland. This is an Inuit from Alaska, in fact from Kivalina, with his Umiak boat. Now, white men, as I told you, moved into northern areas to hunt, and the whales especially, and the fur mammals, and they moved also to find shorter routes leading to China. But at the end of the 19th century, there was other reasons to move into northern countries, and that was essentially discovery for the pure pleasure of discoveries, and also the start of Arctic and oceanographic scientific research. Some pioneering work have been done in this area by many different people, including at the beginning of this century by His Serene Highness Prince Albert of Monaco, and that's one of the reasons for which we did incorporate this Arctic Committee in the state of Monaco. It's because from the turn of the century, the sovereign princes have shown deep interest for research in oceanographic matters and especially in northern areas. On this graph, you can see some of the main voyages, the one by Nordenskjöld, all around the northern rim of Siberia in the years 78 to 79. Nordenskjöld was the first with the Vega to be able to join the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific. Then the other route on the Northwest Passage was made by Roald Amundsen in 1903-1906. You see also the very famous trip of the Fram of Nansen, first navigating the ship up to that place close to the northern eastern Siberia, then freezing the ship in the ice pack, then drifting with the pack for nearly 3 years till the very tip of Svalbard before being free again in the northern Atlantic waters. But the pole was reached first by Peary, starting from Ellesmere Island in 1909, and then by aerial route by Byrd, 1926, then Amundsen Nobile with their dirigible, and Nobile again in 1926 and 1928. We'll see here the Fram when it is frozen in the pack on the north of Siberia. Fridtjof Nansen, one maybe of the greatest explorers of all times, and also a great scholar in Arctic problems. Roald Amundsen, Robert Peary from the US Navy, and here the tracks of the different transarctic flights, including the first successful flight by Nobile and Amundsen in 1926 with a Norge, which went from Vardø to Noalesund, Noalesund to the pole, and the pole ended close to Nam. And the unsuccessful flight, unfortunately, of Nobile alone with the Italia, which reached the pole here in 1928, but iced on the way back, collapsed on the ice pack, and the ship was lost. Here is the dirigible Norge in Noalesund, Svalbard. Here is General Nobile at the end of his life. When I visited him in Rome some 4 years ago, he was 93 at that time, and he had still a very good memory and remembered very well this pioneering period of the transpolar route. The most recent way to explore northern Arctic region, and especially the Arctic Ocean, is of course with the nuclear submarines. And just to remember here the famous track of the Nautilus in 1958, which starting from the Pacific crossed completely the Arctic Ocean under the ice to get free in the neighborhood of Iceland, to surface in the neighborhood of Iceland and get out of the ice pack in the neighborhood of Svalbard. Later on, a nuclear submarine surfaced at the pole. This is the case of the Skate, surfacing at the pole in summer conditions, and later on in winter conditions, you have here the surfacing of the Sargo in 1961 in the month of February. A very elaborate navigation under the ice was done a few years later, in fact in 1962, by two submarines, one starting from the Pacific Ocean, the Sea Dragon, the other one, the Skate, coming from the Davis Strait, which met below the ice in this rendezvous point, northern of the North Siberia Islands, on the 31st of July 1962, and then navigated jointly to the pole, and then under the pack, before splitting again on the northern part of Canada to resume their routing, one towards the Atlantic Ocean, the other one to the Pacific. You see here both submarines surfacing in Apollinia near the Arlist drifting ice station. Now the Arctic Ocean is inhabited by a lot of drifting research stations. You see on this map the Russian drifting station in red, the American or West European drifting station in blue. This was introduced by Joe Fletcher, and for many years the station have been inhabited and they are the support of very active research, as you very well know. This is one of them, the Arlis 2. Now we will spend some time to discuss the special features of this Arctic Ocean and the reason why it constitutes, I think I will remain with the slides, please. And the reason why it constitutes a, you can take the light out, please. It constitutes a kind of very special geographical structure that we have called, like many of the surface, which are holding only 2% of the water mass. And you can see here, on northern Siberia, it extends even more than 1,000 kilometers from the northern area. Inside this Arctic Ocean, you have some very deep trenches. In fact, different basins, the Makarov Basin, the Canadian Basin, the Eurasian Basin, the Fram Basin, down to minus 4,500 to 5,000 meters, which are severed by these cordilleras that we discussed before. The overall temperature is low, and in winter averages minus 25 to minus 30 with a very deep cold area on the central part. So it's not surprising that the surface is covered by permanent ice the year round. As you can see, that ice during the summer, the winter months, can extend southward, adding another 10 million square kilometers of drifting ice to these polar areas. That ice is not stable, that means it is in permanent motion, and it whirls around the central point of the North Pole, as you can see, the successive position of the water mass computed over 6 years, which fits with the different patterns of the currents as we know them in the Arctic Ocean. You see warm influx coming from the Gulf Stream and the North Atlantic Drift, a part of it south of Iceland, the main part pumped into the Barents Sea and into the Fram Strait, where it goes in depth at intermediate level and settles in the Arctic Ocean, circulating counterclockwise to get out later on our surface currents along eastern Greenland and through the northern archipelago here, as well as in the Davis Strait. The exchanges of water through the Bering Strait being rather limited because of the low depths of the Bering Strait and the fact that it is also, as you know, a narrow passage. Most of the exchange is done, as I told you, in the Fram Strait. The total exchange between the outside seas, means Pacific and the Atlantic, with the Arctic Ocean, amounts to at around 9.5 to 10 million Sverdrup, which means about 10 million cubic meter per second of water, which are fed into the Arctic Ocean. And conversely, the same amount of water as cold water is drifted out, either on the surface with floating ice along essentially the East Greenland Current, or in depths cascading over the sills in between Iceland and the Faroes, or Iceland and Greenland. To this water from maritime origin should be added the huge runoffs coming from the different rivers on northern Asiatic part, and also from the rivers like the Mackenzie coming into the Arctic Ocean. As you know, the Yukon is going south and not directly in the Arctic Ocean. This amounts to at around 90,000 cubic meters per second, which is a very reasonable input, about half the one of the most powerful river in the world of the Amazon. With the Atlantic water, salt water is coming into the Arctic Ocean, as you can see here, from the concentration of salt, that it decreases from the top or the tip of the Northern Atlantic towards the central part of the Arctic Ocean. And it settles at intermediate depths. You see here that layer of relatively high saline water and high temperature water settling here in between the surface waters and the deep waters in the Arctic Ocean. A mathematical model has been built on this, which shows essentially two main currents: the transpolar drift, which is driving the water mass from Siberia towards the northern part of the Atlantic. That's a drift which in fact carried the Fram ship of Nansen, and this big vortex at the tip of North America, the Beaufort or Pacific Sea Gyre, which is working clockwise and moves a substantial amount of water on the North American coast. The greatest part of the exchange is done, as I told you, in the Fram Strait. The Fram Strait is a very deep channel, as you can see, in between the Arctic Ocean and the Northern Atlantic. And through that channel, a tremendous amount of water is flown. It is computed now that roughly out of the 9.5 million cubic meter per second of warm Atlantic waters going into the Arctic Ocean, 7.1, that means you see the great majority, is going through the Fram Strait. Hence, the interest of studying the oceanographic and hydrographic conditions in this area. The countercurrent is driving the ice along eastern Greenland, as you can see here, a picture taken offshore in Massalik in eastern Greenland, which shows that drift. And here is some ideas of the direction and importance of the deep water cascading of the cold water from the upper part of the Atlantic Ocean into the lower part over the sill between Iceland on the left and the Faroes. Because of their cold waters and because also of the constant stirring movement of the Arctic Ocean, these waters are potentially very rich in biomass, as far at least as the waters which are not covered by the pack are concerned. This map will show you here the very high productivity of the zooplankton on the northern tip of Scandinavia, also in the Davis Strait and around Iceland. This, of course, will attract a lot of fish, and as an example, here is the distribution patterns of the herring, Atlantico-Scandinavian herring here on the northern tip of Scandinavia with the spawning grounds along the southern part. The Arctic regions are not only a point of old civilization and a point of recent and sustained exploration and research, they are also potentially very rich in a certain number of fossil fuels and also in minerals and ore deposits. As you can see from these slides, the amount of coal in yellow, of oil and gas in green, and of potential oil and gas in unknown or poorly charted areas of northern Canada for the time being, and iron are enormous. This is explained the irrigation drive in the Arctic regions, and you can see here that this is not limited to fossil fuel, but extended to quite a number of mineral ores and interesting resources. Here, for instance, for petroleum, we'll see an enlargement of the Mackenzie Delta area and also of the upper Ob area. You see here in the lower Ob basin, here the amount of gas and oil fields which have been discovered and under exploitation. And here in the Mackenzie Delta, Beaufort Sea, of course, the great fields that you are very familiar with, both in Alaska and in Canada. Now, the recent discoveries of those big fields in very remote areas, like, for instance, that area here north of Canada, in either the Sverdrup Basin or in the Mackenzie Delta, are creating enormous technical difficulties and also major investment if the resources which are on the spot need to be transported in the south markets. You see here, out of the upper Melville Gas discoveries, the routes which have been forecasted to take the pipe down through Canada towards the industrial area of the Great Lakes. This is a tremendous challenge, and one of the main difficulties is in fact to adapt the technology which has been developed offshore in the North Sea and in some other areas of the world, to develop it into a technology which can be used in ice-infested waters. For instance, a semi-submersible drilling rig of this type, or a production platform, steel platform, or concrete platform of that type, have to be engineered in such a way that they can operate into ice-infested water. Here are they are in the North Sea. They are, of course, submitted to very severe stresses from the sea itself and from the wind, but at least they are protected from any drift in ice, no iceberg, no flows, no particular stress on the metallic structure. As you can see, if you are contemplating drilling in areas like, for instance, eastern Greenland, which in many ways could be interesting because it's the mirror image of the North Sea structure along Scandinavia, you have to face this amount of ice, which is drifting even in the best season, and which amounts, of course, to millions and millions of tons of rapidly fast-moving ice, which, of course, is an incompatible obstacle at that point for most of the platform structures. Different technologies have been imagined and some of them tested in order to get rid of that difficulty. One is, for instance, the possibility to make deflected wells from the land if the field is not too far offshore. Other technologies are building derricks on artificial islands in shallow waters and are susceptible to operate in summer or winter. Some will use drilling ships, but will operate, of course, only during the summer season when the water are ice-free. And of course, it needs as a counterpart a recessed well-held silo to secure the protection of the well-held so that the drifting icebergs, which are gouging and which are plowing the sea bottom, does not destroy the well structures. Another possibility is also to build the rig directly on the ice in winter conditions and then drill on a nice thickened platform, which will be restructured again, rebuilt again, at the following winter. Submersible monopods have also been studied with rotating system which could cut or abrase the ice all around, but not great faith. The engineers have not great faith in the solidity and reliability of this type of structure at that point. Also, we can think of heavy submersible or fixed monopod which would have ice-breaking contours and would help making the exploitation both in summer and winter. Now, just to go very quickly through here, the possibility to drill from an ice platform, the idea is quite simple. Water is pumped in depth, and the water deposited at the surface will freeze in the low temperature and will build very quickly a thick ice island which can withstand the weight of the derrick structure and of the operating associated units. This gives you an idea here of this type of structure in northern Canada. I think we'll switch to the second one. The problem is not only, of course, to find the oil or the gas, and here is a well under test in northern Canada, but to evacuate this by appropriate systems, either by ship or else by pipe. Here is one of the projects that you are certainly familiar with, the Polar Gas Project, in which, starting from Melville Island, the gas would be channeled through a long pipe which has to cross through two deep maritime passages. The McClure Strait, which is nearly 76 miles in width and which is rather deep, 500 meters, and in the south, the Dolphin and Union Strait, which is only 19 miles, but which is also 122 meters. A depth for the first one at which we cannot operate with divers in the present conditions. Divers can operate commercially down to roughly 350 meters, but not below. So special technology had to be developed, in which the pipe, for instance, is first assembled in sections of about a couple of miles. Those sections on rolling bearings at the surface of the ice are then deposited in depth and dragged through special systems put at the surface of the ice through which cables can push and pull the tubes in position. You see one of these cable pulling unit installed on ice with the cables going to the immersed tube and dragging the tube, the one against the other. Then when they are together, they still have to be connected, and the welding is done in that case at one atmosphere by the special installation which can close a chamber around the pipe, make it completely sealed and tight, and then be evacuated, the welders coming with a transfer module which can be a submarine or a bell, and susceptible then to operate and weld the pipes in depth. Well, of course, to all these are associated some major risk of pollution, of rupture of the pipes, of rupture of the well heads, of rupture of the locks, and you know that the degradation of oil material is a rather complex matter, and this is just an idea of, for instance, how the different cycles will be done within the different stages of the trophic chain within the polar waters. This is further aggravated by the coverage by ice, because if there is a leak below the ice, this ice will entrap the leak for very long periods, and then the oil, for instance, will get through progressively through the ice, through different channels, and will gather on the surface, capt the sun energy, and then melt the ice in surface. Could I have the light, please? So, as you can see, the Arctic regions, which were once desolated areas, and which have been pioneering areas for many, many years, are now at the turn of a completely new period. And that new period, in many ways, will be a very exciting but difficult undertaking. As I told you today, regular airliners crisscross the North Pole area. Numerous research stations drift on the polar back. Powerful nuclear-propelled icebreakers circumnavigate the Arctic Ocean, and into the silent depths of northern icy waters, strategic submarines swim undetected under the protective shield of the permanent ice, carrying a formidable load of transcontinental ballistic missiles. At the rim of the polar sea, new airports and research bases hum with activity, and over the vast expanse of the frozen barren lands, the yellow flares of the test wheels roar into the Arctic nights. But the caribou herds still migrate in the tundra, and they wander within the oil sites. The derricks and the huge radar and transmission antennae neighbor with traditional native huts, while in the dark blue waters of the loose summer pack, the mechanical groan of the submersible drilling rigs has replaced the occasional flap of the sails in the wind. These exciting ventures, how impressive locally, remain dispersed enterprises. And despite this sudden uprise of multifocal activity, there lie hundreds, thousands of miles of Arctic desert between these tiny human settlements. This is one of the difficulties of the Arctic regions. They present open blue skies of crystal transparency or dense, deadly icing fogs. They have huge potential mineral resources, but scattered in one of the most hostile environments of the Earth. They have unlimited lands for human expansion, but cultural, historical, and political constraints fence communities within narrow limits. They have hundreds of thousands of square miles of fishing grounds over the fertile banks of Arctic waters, but violent gales, drifting ice, and fierce competition between home fleets and interlopers are going along. In the huge deep taigas, indefinite biological resources can be found, but they are also susceptible to be wiped out for decennia or even centuries by accidental or irresponsible fires. There is a fascinating and elaborate wildlife. Last remnant, maybe, of the world's original natural schemes, which shows an unbelievable resistance to a harsh climate, maybe the harshest of all, but which are also liable to disappear almost completely if their delicate biological equilibriums are unbalanced. The Arctic regions are regions of contrast, of power and weakness, of dramatic and destructive beauty, which can become wonderland or grave. The big problem, the unique problem which lies in front of us now, is to know how we can achieve the greatest economic development in those regions with the maximum benefit for the existing communities and the least social, cultural, and political disruption possible, together with, of course, a reasonable reward for the mainland entrepreneur forces who take the major technical risk and bear the utmost financial load. Once more again, it is absolutely essential in those areas to keep in reasonable balance environmental issues and national developments and needs, and to design an appropriate policy to prevent any irreversible damage to major environmental sites, and to try and never weigh present and long-term public health against economical premiums, whatever glittering they look like. This is, of course, a difficult issue, because the Arctic entrepreneurs are not the only one. And as you know, many sources of pollution lie far away from the Arctic regions. And it has been shown, for instance, that the Arctic haze, which invades the northern part of the North American Arctic, is coming in great part from the pollution plumes of the European and Western Russian power plants and steel works. And they travel over 15,000 miles, almost untouched, to be deposited later on in this cold trap of the Arctic regions, drawn to the surface by subsidence into the polar ice. There is no doubt also that the development of the Arctic region is one of the biggest economical program and challenge of the future. But it is also equally true that these huge potential resources will require tremendous effort in very difficult conditions. This implies not only a very big effort on the technical side, but also an increased labor force moving into the boreal countries. Not particularly for petroleum operations, which require only limited skilled personnel, but for mining, transport, supporting activities. Millions of square kilometers of exclusive economic zone are still unexploited. And the recent move in Arctic areas for instance, in Siberia, is something which has no precedent. About 10 million people in less than 20 years. And the problem is, of course, that these new people, these new dwellers of the Arctic, have to fit within a given pattern, a given structure, and that their presence has to avoid, to disrupt the natives and the old dwellers and rupture their tradition. This is even so sensitive that in the USSR, the Partre Central Committee and the Council of Ministers made strong recommendations on the ways and means to help the evolution of Northern people without impairing their individual socio-cultural heritage. Everybody can easily understand that this is utterly difficult, and that in most instances, in many instances, it is unfortunately also pure wishful thinking. No doubt that the once desolated, silent, forbidden northern regions will become, within the next 20 years, a zone of intense activity and hopefully friendly competition. Let us hope that this will occur in the respect of the original lands and cultures, and without impairing the environment, and that in that prodigious effort to conquer the axis of the earth, people and nations, in their way up to the pole, will climb to higher standards and join in the fraternal cooperation, as in the Gothic cathedrals, the elegant stone arches converge and fuse together at the top of the vaults. Thank you.
Very late, but would you perhaps be willing to answer one or two questions
from
the audience? Sure. Yes. Is there helium in natural gas?
Sorry?
Is there helium content in natural gas?
Oh, it's very, very minute. There's, you know, no interest for direct exploitation at that point, from what I know. You know, the natural gas has, of course, not an even composition from one point to another one. It depends upon the wells, it depends upon the fields. But as far as I know, I have seen no plans for the recovery of the helium content in those areas. You know, helium is essentially coming from the degassing of rocks which are containing radioactive material, and for that reason, it's not generally found in the same areas. Yes?
One oil spill under the ice of, say, 10,000 gallons of crude.
What would be, sorry?
How long would it take, or what damage would it do to all of the life if 10,000 gallons of oil were spilled?
Below the ice? Yeah. Well, you know, the big problem of spilling of the oil or of any chemical below the ice surface is the fact that, unfortunately, the cover of ice prevents the natural exchange with atmosphere. That means that the oil slick cannot be beaten by the winds, cannot evaporate, cannot be heat pumped by the sun, and remains entrapped. So as long as the oil remains below the ice surface and remains in a rather limited zone, the damage is not that great, because under the ice, anyhow, the biological activity during the dark period is